In Haiti, the Prime Minister's whereabouts are unknown, and violence is at a tipping point.
It's a country basically leaderless and with gangs all over the place attacking key institutions, including the international airport.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. From Uganda, we'll hear about an American who came to help orphans.
We are appreciating the work he's doing for us. We loved him very much. Whenever we used to see him, we are smiling.
Smiling until allegations of child abuse came to light.
A satellite that can measure methane emissions could help with climate change. Also, the critical role of sand dunes.
Sand dunes act like a bit of a sponge because when it rains, the rainwater goes straight into the sand.
There's a good reason oases are so close to dunes.
All that and more today on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. We start today in Haiti, where an already serious security crisis is getting even worse. Heavily armed gangs tried to take control of Haiti's main international airport in Port-au-Prince, where they exchanged gunfire with police and security forces. Over the weekend, the gangs attacked government sites, including two of Haiti's biggest prisons, with thousands of inmates escaping in the chaos.
The government appears to be paralyzed. Prime Minister Ariel Henry was last seen in Kenya. He was in talks there with Kenyan officials about sending peacekeeping troops to Haiti, but that effort has been stalled. Widlaw Merancourt is the editor-in-chief of Aibo Post in Port-au-Prince. His descriptions of violence in Haiti the past few days will be upsetting to some listeners. We started by asking him, where exactly is the prime minister now?
Right now, nobody knows the whereabouts of the Haitian prime minister. Last time he was seen in Kenya last week, and I've seen reports that he's right now in the U.S., but it's unclear when he's going to be in Haiti. So it's a country basically leaderless and with gangs all over the place attacking key institutions, including the international airport and police stations, and attacking prisons, releasing, like you said, thousands of inmates, including some of the most dangerous in the streets right now.
What do you think it says about the country's political leaders that the top one is missing in this moment of crisis?
Well, it's not surprising, quite frankly. Ariel Henry came in power right after the assassination of Jovenel Moïse July 7, 2021. And the two main objectives he had was to pacify the country that was, before he became prime minister, with the help of the international community, but mainly the U.S., was already under, you know, gang control. The country that has and still has, you know, zero elected officials could have some semblance of normalcy. Haiti is worse today than it was right after the assassination of the president. And right now, gangs are patrolling the streets. The morale in the, you know, police is at an all-time low, according to, you know, interviews I conducted. So a couple of days before the attack at the National Penitentiary, police officers who were there could see all over social media videos of police officers being decapitated, assassinated with machetes. Was that in the context when they were under attack by gangs and they called for help, they called, but nothing happened. So we are in a situation in Haiti where the leadership is severely contested. It's missing in action, and the gangs are determined to, you know, topple the government. And this is coming in a context when the government is trying to bring some international force in this country to restore order.
And what do we know about the attack at the airport, Widlaw? I mean, among many bad signs of violence in Haiti, that seems especially worrying.
So the attack at the airport comes right after Jimmy Chéri, the biggest gang leader in Haiti. He was a police officer. He announced the reunion of the biggest gang in Haiti to attack the actual government and topple Ariel Henry's administration. So after this announcement, many institutions were attacked, including several police stations, but also the airport. Planes that were at the tarmac of the airport received bullets. Employees flee the space en masse because they feared for their lives. and local flights were cancelled by the companies. And increasingly, we are also hearing international companies saying that they, for the time being, they are going to stop flying planes to Haiti. And allegedly, the gangs are getting ready for the return of the prime minister.
So I saw a video in an Associated Press report, and it showed gang leader Jimmy Cherizier, a.k.a. Barbecue, seemingly making a statement to the Haitian public. I want us to listen to that. Widlaw, what was he saying?
Well, he's asking the Haitian population not to run away if they see the gangs in the streets, because the gangs are there to attack the enemies of his coalition, that would be politicians and folks in the government. But this is a rhetoric that we've heard from Jimmy Cherizier, you know, so many times. He's some sort of folk hero who would come and attack the riches and the corrupts and help the Haitian people. However, that rhetoric is just what it is, a rhetoric. The folks that the gangs are attacking, poor people in Haiti, the folks that are being killed today, the small merchants that are in the streets, the folks that are being attacked are also police officers. So many of them are extremely poor. When gangs comes to neighborhoods, it means mass rape. It means burning of houses. It means looting. It means total destruction.
So the last time Prime Minister Henri was seen was in Kenya, negotiating that possibility of Kenyan troops coming to help with this situation. What do Haitians want right now?
Well, I think Haitian people agree on two things. The first one is most people don't trust the Haitian National Police. It was proven that they were ineffective. So most people will tell you that to take down the gangs, we need some outside help to bring about some sense of peace and normalcy in the country. But the second thing that people broadly accept is the fact that they distrust the current government. They see the government as an illegitimate group of folks. They are not seen as being competent. So people are also asking the international community to kind of stop supporting Ariel Henry's government and kind of let the Haitian folks make some sort of political agreement that could pacify the country enough while they tamp down and attack the gangs.
Widlaw Meroncourt is the editor-in-chief of Aibo Post. He joined us from Port-au-Prince, where Haiti's government and much of the public is dealing with a worsening security crisis.
A phone hacking incident revealed on Friday is creating embarrassment for the German military. Today, Germany's defense minister Boris Pistorius provided some details about it. Apparently, Russia was able to intercept a conference call with high-ranking military officers from across Europe. Pistorius said a German military officer did not use a secured phone line when he joined the call from a hotel in Singapore.
Pistorius called the hack a real find for Russia's intelligence services. He said it was a chance hit as part of a broad, scattered approach. What the Russian interception revealed was four high-ranking German Air Force officers having a conversation about how, hypothetically, Ukraine might use German long-range cruise missiles against invading Russian forces. Pistorius said the damage done by the actual content of the leaked audio was manageable. He said the real success for Russia is that the leak is influencing how the war in Ukraine is being discussed in Germany right now.
And carnival season is already over in most places it's celebrated, but not in Uruguay. Even though neighboring Brazil gets all the glory, Uruguay claims to have the world's largest carnival. It starts in January and runs for 40 days or longer, and it is more than colorful parades. Carnival in Uruguay is an outdoor musical theater competition, as the world's Tibi Sai Se reported during last year's carnival season. Llegamos al carnaval.
It's summer in Uruguay, and during this time of the year, you can find pop-up stages across the capital, Montevideo. Every night, people go out to see groups performing a unique type of musical theater. It's called murga. The performance groups are made up of 13 singers, mostly men. accompanied by three percussionists and a musical director. They all wear elaborate costumes and colorful makeup.
Y es un carnaval muy teatralizado que se desarrolla en escenarios al aire libre.
Juan Castel is the director of the Carnival Museum in Montevideo. He says the entire carnival season in Uruguay is structured as an outdoor theater festival.
Voy a conocer al novio de mi nieta. No. ¿Cómo será? Señor.
There is a weeks-long competition held at the Teatro de Verano, or Summer Theater.
Acá el concurso de carnaval se vive como si fuera un campeonato de fútbol, prácticamente.
Uruguayans live the carnival like a soccer tournament, Castel says, with playoffs and a final. Each group performs a 45-minute show, which they have written themselves and rehearsed for months.
A la murga acá se le exigen tres cosas: criticar, hacer reír y emocionar.
He says audiences demand three main things from murga performances: humor, political or social commentary, and some moving moments.
And so that could be commenting on anything from football to the presidency to international affairs.
That's Natalie Kirstein, a musicologist who's been studying Uruguayan murga for decades.
So people find themselves reflected and they feel like their issues are seen and heard and performed and spoken.
The tradition is more than 100 years old. It came from Cádiz in Spain. At that time, it was a form of entertainment for the working class, drawing on sounds of daily life. But in Uruguay, a military dictatorship in the 1970s and 80s brought a lot of change. Murga singer Horacio Pesaroglo says, especially at that time, people wanted to speak out against the government.
Funcionaba una censura previa.
But there was a lot of censorship. The government created a special commission that would revise murga scripts before they went on stage. Singers, however, found ways to get around the censors.
A través de la poesía, digamos, y de las metáforas.
Through poetry and metaphors, they hit messages that were missed by the authorities. Like in this famous murga from 1982, when the director suddenly stops the music.
Y el día en que enmudezcan las guitarras.
The day our guitars go silent.
Y ningún instrumento esté sonando.
And no instruments are playing.
Quedará la garganta enronquecida, rumbo a la madrugada, caminando.
We'll still have our voices that will keep singing until the early morning. Part of the legacy of those years of dictatorship is that murgas have become more political and their lyrics more sophisticated. There are more groups now and their shows turned into professional productions.
Tiene que haber iluminadores, tiene que haber sonidistas, escenógrafos, vestuaristas, maquilladores.
They now hire set designers, lighting experts and makeup artists. Some of them even have sponsors and YouTube channels. Others keep things simple and perform outside of the main competition. But they all aim to create theater and humor around the issues of the day. Most of the performers are volunteers. And when carnival season is over in Uruguay, they go back to their daily lives. Because, as Horacio Pesaroglo says, murga performers don't represent the people. They are the people. For the world, I'm Tibi Saise.
You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. The United Nations has issued a report on allegations of sexual violence committed during the Hamas attacks on October 7th. We're going to dive into those findings, which might not be suitable for all listeners. The UN report found that there are reasonable grounds to believe that incidents of sexual violence took place in at least three locations in southern Israel that day that included rape and gang rape. Speaking on Monday, UN Special Envoy Pramila Patton said they also reviewed evidence of what happened to hostages held in the Gaza Strip.
We found clear and convincing information that sexual violence, including rape, sexualized torture, cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment, has been committed against captives. And we also have reasonable grounds to believe that such violence may still be ongoing against those still held in captivity.
Christina Lamb was one of the first reporters to travel to Israel and examine claims that emerged after October 7th. She's the chief foreign correspondent for the Sunday Times.
The United Nations took a very long time, UN Women and also Pramila Patten's office, to actually make any comment at all, despite the fact Israeli women organizations were contacting them with information, and they didn't even, you know, respond. The fact that they say that there is clear and convincing information that this took place, this, I suppose, is a vindication, you know, it's rather grim vindication, but for those organizations that felt they were not being listened to.
You and other journalists have reported previously on incidences of sexual violence connected to the Hamas attacks. What impact does it have for some of this to be documented by the UN specifically?
Yeah, it's very important because, you know, when I've spoken to survivors of sexual violence in conflicts across the world, almost all of them say that what they most want is justice. But I think justice means different things to different people. It doesn't necessarily mean seeing your perpetrator in court being sentenced. It can just mean actually your story being listened to. So that is the first step.
So you mentioned interviews being done. The UN fact finders reviewed 50 hours of footage of the attacks, more than 5,000 images, they say, and interviewed 34 individuals, including survivors and witnesses of the October 7th attacks. But Pramila Patten, who led the UN documentation effort, also said this.
We did not meet with any survivor of sexual violence of the 7th of October attacks, despite our efforts. On the very first day, I made a call for survivors to come forward, but we received information that a handful of them were receiving very specialized trauma treatment and were not prepared to come forward.
Talking to therapists who were working with the survivors seems like the closest anyone has come to talking to the survivors themselves. Did your conversations convince you that these allegations were true?
Yes, of course. I wouldn't have written about it otherwise.
What did they tell you about their clients' accounts?
I had exactly the same experience, which is that I was able to talk to witnesses of sexual violence. I spoke to some of the emergency first responders who had the rather gruesome task of collecting bodies, and spoke about, you know, the state that they found some of the bodies of young women. What I didn't find was any actual survivors. Now, having written about this subject for a long time in many places, I know that this is very difficult for people to talk about. And, you know, I've met people who didn't speak about it for 50 years.
Yeah. This sexual violence is both, of course, deeply disturbing. And the accounts are also divisive. They're wrapped up in a very, very polarized conflict. Is there anything about the public discussion of these UN findings that you think folks should keep in mind if they're trying to understand what really happened here?
A lot of people said to me, why are you not writing what the Israelis are doing to the Palestinians? You know, I'm not saying that you shouldn't look at both sides. Of course you should, but they're sort of separate stories. You're looking at one issue and then you go and investigate another. It's in a book, I would look at both, but for an article, I'm looking at one side. So we know that this is an extremely polarizing conflict, and a lot of people feel that it's not possible to both be horrified by what happened to Israelis on October the 7th, but also be completely horrified by what Israel is doing in Gaza.
Christina Lamb is the chief foreign correspondent for the Sunday Times. We'll have more on this story tomorrow on The World.
Here's something that piqued our interest this week. Research into the age of sand. The study looks specifically at one massive sand dune in Morocco. The Lala Lalia is what's known as a star dune.
Over a long time, as you say, if you're taking a time slice, then you would see a consistent movement, a sort of rotation of the dunes, like a sort of octopus's tentacles creeping out across the desert.
Charles Bristow is a sedimentologist who's researched the age of Lala Lalia.
One of the things we learned was this dune was actually younger than we thought. The dune is about 100 meters high, so that's over 300 feet. But it's actually been constructed or moved into where it is now in just 900 years, which for a 100 meter high dune, that's pretty impressive for me anyway. I thought this dune was going to be a lot older.
So why is all this important? I mean, you're not just looking at pretty sand dunes.
This particular dune is close to an oasis. So knowing how fast or how slowly it moves is important to the local inhabitants. It's getting closer and closer to the oasis. That's where they live. That's what they depend on for their water supply. And the oasis has palm trees, and then they cultivate vegetables and things in between the palm trees.
So is your research kind of providing almost an early warning system so these oases don't get buried in sand?
Yeah, that's one of the rationales for studying sand dunes and the rates at which they migrate, is if there's human infrastructure which is in the way, then we need to know so that people can plan. But it's moving sufficiently slowly that we'd have effectively a lifetime to plan for it.
Do sand dunes play a role in their ecosystems that may not be obvious to most people?
They do. And one of the intriguing points is on the subject of water and oases. Sand dunes act like a bit of a sponge because when it rains, the rainwater goes straight into the sand. And there's relatively little evaporation on the surface because there's less vegetation there. So the water soaks straight in. Whereas if you're on the areas between the dunes, what we call the interdune areas, they're often quite hard and rocky, and water will run off. And that basically disappears, whereas the water that is within the dune sinks down and is held within the sand dune till it gets towards the base of the dune, and then it'll start to move sideways. And that's one of the reasons why you'll see oases right next to sand dunes.
Oh, interesting.
It's actually the water is coming from the sand dune.
What is it about sand that has stoked your interest so much for so long?
I guess it goes back to sort of being a small kid playing on the beach, building sandcastles. I was lucky as I grew up to become a geologist and then to be exploring in the desert. And I've had a really interesting career, or for me, it's been an interesting career.
Charles Bristow is a professor of sedimentology at Birkbeck University of London. His research helps explain the age of a massive sand dune in Morocco. You're listening to The World.
One of the soccer stars from last year's Women's World Cup is accused of racist abuse toward a London cop.
It's very serious allegations. It regards racism, and there's no place for racism in our sport. She's pleaded not guilty. I think we need to remember that.
The incident in question happened over a year ago, and fans are in shock. That's ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Decades ago, the United States moved away from orphanages as a way to care for children who had lost their parents. Research showed this kind of institutional care was harmful to kids, leading to developmental delays and emotional issues for many. And yet today, Americans continue to send millions of dollars to orphanages in other countries.
Experts say an orphanage industry has developed in some countries, like Uganda. That is the focus of investigative reporting we're bringing you all this week. Today, we examine one chain of children's homes where kids allege they were emotionally, physically, and sexually abused. Now adults, they shared graphic stories about their treatment with The World's Halima Gakandi for this story.
The town of Kayabwe in central Uganda has become a bit of a tourist stop because it sits along the equator line. Vendors sell beaded jewelry, printed clothes, and other souvenirs. A few paces away is the Aid Child Equator Shop and Cafe, which has been around for more than 20 years. Inside, above the checkout counter, is a big red banner that reads, "All profits to students living with HIV.
Aid Child is real hope in Uganda. It's a home for orphans living with AIDS, where they're loved and nurtured one by one, one at a time.
Aid Child was founded by Nathaniel Dunnigan, a self-described missionary from Arizona. He first arrived in Uganda in 1998 and was inspired to help the estimated 1.7 million AIDS orphans there, many of whom were HIV positive themselves.
So many of them were suffering, and as I saw it, they were suffering unnecessarily. I just encountered so many precious little ones who were burning up with fevers that were being untreated and suffering from skin conditions that weren't being cared for. It affected me so dramatically that I just couldn't go home and pretend that I hadn't seen it.
So in 2000, Dunnigan founded Aid Child. At first, the goal was to offer palliative and hospice care for HIV-positive children who were not expected to live long. But with the help of medication and adequate nutrition, the children at Aid Child were surviving, he has said. That's when Aid Child transformed to include a children's home for kids who they said did not have the support of their extended families. Dunnigan's work quickly got attention in and outside of Uganda. He testified before Congress about AIDS orphans, and his organization received funding from USAID, which Dunnigan has said he used to help start up the Aid Child Equator Cafe as a way to generate sustainable income for his work. Aid Child is now located in Entebbe, about a two-hour drive from the cafe. Nearby, at a park on the shores of Lake Victoria, I meet one young man who grew up at Aid Child. He asked to remain anonymous because he fears potential repercussions for speaking out. He tells me the early years at Aid Child were really good. The organization was well-staffed, and as children, they were well-provided for.
Before, life was okay. We were eating very good, and everything in time. We were given clothes, nice clothes, nice meals with drinks. Everything was okay.
He and many of the people I have interviewed who grew up at Aid Child tell me that as children, they really loved Dunnigan and saw him as a father figure.
We loved our dad. We loved Nathaniel very much because we appreciated the work he's doing for us. We loved him very much. Whenever we used to see him, we are smiling.
Within a few years, Aid Child expanded to open additional children's homes in other districts. By 2011, they had nearly tripled the number of children in their care, to 96 children living with HIV/AIDS, according to their public tax documents. They also said they had supported more than 3,000 additional kids through their clinics. According to sources, things began to change for the worst around 2009. During that time, Dunnigan had traveled back to the United States to pursue higher education. So day-to-day management of the children's home was left to his Ugandan partner, Chief of Staff Tom Nsereko. The young man who grew up at the home says that food was the first thing to change.
We started eating only sweet potatoes, even sometimes without sauce. Just sweet potato and a cup of water. Sweet potato and a cup of water. Everything changed. Yogurt, those things, they all disappeared away from the menu. Eggs, they all disappeared away from the menu.
Some people I interviewed who grew up at the home recalled being so hungry they stole maize and jackfruit from their neighbors' gardens. Seven others who were old enough to remember this period told me that their basic needs sometimes weren't being met. Around this time, according to a government official in one of the districts Aid Child used to operate in, residents in the local community reported Aid Child for mistreating children. They told me they inspected Aid Child in 2009 and found the location was dirty, had sick children without a nurse on site, and there were kids out of school. Meanwhile, in the U.S., Dunnigan continued to receive donations and accolades for his work and posted pictures of smiling children on his website, mailing list, and social media pages.
You could smile because the other things still we need. If we could not smile and bring what they want, we would not go to school. That's the reason why we used to smile, even if we are not happy.
Around 2013, Joan Matesi says she joined Aid Child as a nurse. I meet her at her home. Thomas and Friends plays on the TV in the background for her child.
A passion developed in me. I love children. So as I told you, I always pray. So I told the Lord, lead me. I want to have kids around me. Lead me to that.
Mutesi says she liked the work and the mission, but she noticed several challenges, including food. Sometimes it wasn't adequate.
Like the things would not be bought the right way they are supposed to be bought. Yeah, because we always had a timetable of meals that you're supposed to follow and what. But according to the person who was doing the shopping, would tell you maybe the money is not enough, what, things like that. But back in your mind, you feel like, no, things are not adding up.
But Mutesi's biggest concern was the treatment of the children. She alleges other staff, including the caretakers who were referred to as aunties, could be abusive. She remembers hearing them tell children they were found in dustbins or were abandoned.
So I think the way for them, they felt like disciplining a child, you have to really talk these bad words, hit them. Someone would hit a kid and you think he's hitting a snake. And like, oh my God.
At least four people who grew up at Aid Child told me they were hit or saw other children being beaten or caned by aunties. Mutesi tells me she worried about the psychological impact this was having on the children. She says she left around 2016. The next year, Aid Child would undergo a major transformation. It was 2017, and Aid Child founder Nathaniel Dunnigan decided to rebrand his organization, Aid Child, into ALI, or the Aid Child Leadership Institute. They relocated to a large multi-story house in Entebbe. By this point, many of the babies and infants who had grown up at Aid Child's children's homes were now teenagers and young adults. At this new institute, they were labeled interns. The organization says they are supporting the next generation of leaders for an HIV-free generation. But according to interviews with nine young adults who grew up at Aid Child, behind the scenes, they allege they were experiencing abuse at the hands of Dunnigan himself. I meet another young man who grew up at Aid Child during his lunchtime. He tells me part of his job as an intern was to do chores at Dunnigan's house.
He hit me most of the times when I went there to work for him, but probably it happened when he was drunk. Then in the morning he could say sorry, but it was so shocking that every time he could tell you sorry after hitting you a couple of times.
In total, eight people who grew up at Aid Child allege Dunnigan hit or beat them. Nine people also allege Dunnigan would emotionally abuse them.
Most of the words he used were psychologically torturing because he could surface you to a situation that you are not going to be anything in this world. You are a black monkey, black. So he used to use some really hurting words. He could tell us that according to your status, however much you go out, you cannot last even a day. And that was the most painful thing. Most of us are trying to live more and more years to prove him wrong.
In addition to this alleged emotional and physical abuse, four people who grew up at Aid Child say Dunnigan touched them inappropriately. This other young man was one of them.
So he found us at the sink when we were washing. Then suddenly started touching my genitals, like, was rubbing my stuff like that. So I was like, then I felt bad. Then I pushed his hand away. Then maybe he felt ashamed. Then he went. Then he came back. Then he touched my buttocks. And I was like, what? I was so scared.
I asked these young men how this all made them feel after growing up seeing Dunnigan as a father figure.
No one wanted to call him dad anymore because of the way he behaved towards us. So no one had that love. I can't call him dad. They may call him doctor as he wants.
At least two former staff I interviewed told me they remember being told about these allegations at the time. One of them is Joan Mutesi, the nurse we heard from earlier. Mutesi says Dunnigan lived in a separate house, away from the children's home. She remembers the teenagers who were being sent to work at his house telling her about these alleged abuses.
They were really affected also by that, and they really had it created a fear between, they really feared him. Those moments when he could get drunk or even staying with him.
In 2019, abuse and neglect allegations were also raised by someone who grew up at Aid Child during a meeting with government officials. A former government official who heard these allegations at the time told me they don't think the allegations were followed up on because the individual was past 18 at that point. In a 2001 email, a concerned third party also raised concerns about severe abuse allegations they had received from two people who grew up at the home. I reached out to Aid Child's founder, Nathaniel Dunnigan, and his Ugandan chief of staff, Tom Nsereko, for comment. They said they categorically deny all of the allegations, that they were in excellent standing with the Ugandan government, and that there had never been any allegation internally or externally against them. Aid Child also said that they are, quote, endorsed, recommended, and overseen as a children's home by the ministry responsible for oversight of children's homes. They shared several documents to prove this, but those documents and interviews with government officials did not support the claim. During this investigation, I meet up with Shafiq Butanda to find out more about Aid Child's status with the government. He heads the Alternative Care Unit in the Ministry of Gender, Labor, and Social Development, which oversees children's homes. I meet him at a local food joint in Jinja, in eastern Uganda. I read out some of the abuse, neglect, and misconduct allegations I had heard not only at Aid Child, but also at other children's homes.
Food, shelter, schooling, clothes, those things.
Spiritual nourishment, guidance and counseling, immunization, vaccination, protection, all those.
For home, especially when one of these foreign homes, if they're not doing that, then they're failing to meet the...
Very good. It means that if a home is not providing that, it means that they are actually neglecting the child. And neglect in Uganda is a criminal offense.
He points out Uganda has strict regulations and rules for operating children's homes. They explicitly state that staff cannot do physical, emotional, or psychological harm to children. It also states that homes are meant to be transitional spaces.
Because the children's home is a transitional center. It's not a permanent place for the child. It's not a permanent solution for the children's issues.
I ask him whether Aid Child or the Aid Child Leadership Institute is approved by the ministry to have children in their care.
They are not there. Those ones are not there. And if they are presenting themselves as children's homes, then they are illegal homes. And I want to advise them that they better close them.
Three current and former government officials have confirmed that Aid Child is not legally approved to be caring for children on a permanent basis. So why are there still children in their care? In January, I traveled to the address Aid Child lists on their website. It's in Entebbe. I approach the front gates and ring the doorbell, hoping to speak with one of the adult staff members there. Instead, a minor opens the gates. I ask them how many children are there. One tells me they can't say and directs me to call the number of their chief of staff. Over email, Aid Child said they are transitioning out of providing residential care for children as they move towards the next phase of their organization to engage interns and students to promote an HIV-free generation. They said they currently have 9 children in their care whose biological families are unknown. In response to the allegations in this story, Aid Child shared some examples of the successes of the organization, including a list of young adults who have received higher education. According to Aid Child's own tax records, they had nearly 100 children in their care at one point. So what happened to all the rest of the children who grew up in their care? The answers I found so far have been bleak. During my investigation, I visited a single room shared by several young people who tell me they grew up at Aid Child. When I visit, there's a single bed and a mattress on the floor in the corner.
How many people slept here last night?
Six.
Six.
Yeah.
So some on this bed, some on the mattress, some on the floor.
Yeah.
One young man here describes his last few years at Aid Child as being extremely difficult. He too says he experienced verbal and physical abuse from Dunnigan. But he tells me he persevered through this because he really wanted to finish his education.
I know if you're not educated, you may not have a bright future in the coming years. So that's what I had in my heart.
This young man says Aid Child failed to live up to their promises to continue his secondary education. Another young man here, who also says they grew up at Aid Child, tells me sometimes they go days without eating or survive on mangoes or jackfruit hanging from nearby trees. Remember, these are young people living with HIV or taking antiretroviral medications to help them stay alive.
I remember one time I took them, I had taken like one day without eating, and I had to take drugs because I want to live, I want to go on with life. And I just found myself falling down, like I was so helpless, like I was so weak.
The young people who say they grew up at Aid Child tell me how they have had to rely on each other to meet their basic needs, including education, food, and housing. Others tell me they have sought out relatives who they had been separated from for years for support. After we finish our interview, this young man tells me what he prays for every day, that just one of the kids who grew up at Aid Child might make it and help the rest.
So that's my prayer. Maybe someone could help us, someone could hold our hands and help us maybe. Because I've tried my best, I've looked for people to fund me, and I really want to study, but I've failed.
On social media, Aid Child's founder, Nathaniel Dunnigan, continues to praise the achievements of his organization, which remains unlicensed to have children permanently in their care. For The World, I'm Halima Gekandi, Uganda.
The conditions alleged at Aid Child are not unique to that organization. Tomorrow, our investigation continues with a look at a children's home started by a Dutch couple, where children also allege they were subjected to abuse and neglect.
Stay with us all this week for our reporting on the systemic problems facing orphanages in Uganda. More global news is still ahead. You're listening to The World.
You are listening to The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Last summer, the Women's World Cup was co-hosted by Australia, and one of the standout stars was hometown hero Sam Kerr.
Running 1v2 at the moment. Kerr has help coming. Sam Kerr fires. Go! Kerr! One.
Kerr plays for Australia's women's national team and Chelsea FC in London. The 30-year-old striker is again in the spotlight, but for a very different reason. She's been charged with racially aggravated harassment of a London police officer. The World's Bianca Hillier covers sports for us and has been following this story. Hey, Bianca.
Hi, Carolyn.
So this charge is from an alleged incident from January of 2023, I understand. What do we know about what happened?
So Kerr was in the UK at the time playing for her club team, Chelsea. She had just scored a hat trick the day before against Liverpool. And police say the January 30th charge has to do with some kind of complaint over a taxi fare in Twickenham, a suburb southwest of London. A police officer is reported to have gotten involved, and Kerr is charged with racially aggravated harassment of that officer. You might be wondering what that means. We don't know. That's all the information we have at this time.
Got it. So if this happened more than a year ago, why is she only being charged now?
Well, she was charged on January 21st of this year. So you're right, a year after the alleged incident. And it's not clear why it took that long. And yesterday, she pleaded not guilty in court. So that's when the news broke to the public. So there are definitely a lot of unanswered questions here, but we will have to wait for authorities to release some of those details.
Is this case expected to go to trial?
Yeah, Kerr will appear in court just outside of London in February of next year, 2025. It's a criminal trial, and it's expected to last 4 or 5 days.
So Sam Kerr was such a darling of the soccer world last summer, I remember. How are fans reacting to this news?
The general sense from fans is really one of shock. Kerr is a national hero at home in Australia. Last year, she carried her country's flag at the coronation of King Charles in Westminster Abbey, and she's been praised for championing inclusion. There are just so few details right now that people are waiting for more information to come to light.
So that's fan reaction. What about the world of professional soccer, her teams and her teammates?
Right. Her club team, Chelsea FC, has not yet made a statement. But her boss back in Australia, Football Australia, it's the sport's national governing body, they have spoken out. Here's CEO James Johnson speaking to the media today.
It's very serious allegations. It regards racism, and there's no place for racism in our sport. She's pleaded not guilty. I think we need to remember that. I haven't spoken to Sam other than a text message just to check in on her well-being, because she is an employee of ours and is also a player.
And Carolyn, I want to note, too, that Football Australia and the national team head coach, Tony Gustafson, have both said that they first found out about all of this along with the rest of us in the media. Some people are now questioning why Kerr would not have informed them beforehand.
So pivoting back to sports for just a second here, the Summer Olympics are coming up. Is there any sense of whether Kerr might be playing or not with this case pending?
The team is going to the Olympics. Australia has qualified. But Kerr is actually recovering from an ACL injury right now and hasn't played since January. So we won't be seeing her on the field for a while. But to be clear, that has nothing to do with these charges.
The World's Bianca Hillier reporting on charges against Australia's star soccer player, Sam Kerr.
A SpaceX rocket took off yesterday with a possible climate solution on board. It is the focus of today's installment of The Big Fix.
Change is coming.
Can we turn this around?
We have no other option.
What we do now will profoundly affect the next few thousand years.
The satellite launched yesterday is a collaboration between U.S. scientists and the New Zealand Space Agency. It's meant to track a key climate warming gas. GBH's Craig LaMolt reports.
Okay, this is a model of methane sat.
In his office at the Harvard University Center for the Environment, Stephen Wolfsey picks up a model of the satellite he and his team designed.
These are the solar panels, and these actually fold out like that, so they'll be about that long when they're done. It's actually going to be quite a big bird.
That solar panel wingspan is about 30 feet, and the satellite is about the size of a washing machine, he says.
The spectrometers are here.
Wolfsey points to two devices sticking out from the bottom of the model.
The spectrometer is carefully designed so that it can measure the spectroscopic signature of methane in the atmosphere.
Methane is a greenhouse gas 80 times more powerful than carbon dioxide over its first 20 years in the atmosphere. And the goal of the satellite is to get a detailed global picture of where it's being emitted from.
Methane is responsible for currently for about 30% of the warming we're experiencing.
That's Stephen Hamburg with the Environmental Defense Fund, which is picking up the $88 million tab to build and launch the satellite.
If we can reduce the emissions of methane from human causes, sources, we can rapidly reduce the rate of increase in the warming. So it's an opportunity over the next couple of decades to slow things down.
Those human causes include landfills and agriculture. But Hamburg says the main target of the satellite is detecting methane emissions from the oil and gas industry.
Some call it the low-hanging fruit. I like to call it fruit lying on the ground. We can really reduce those emissions, and we can do it rapidly and see the benefits.
This is not the only satellite up there that can detect methane. But Wolfsey says it's the only one that can measure it at this scale. Looking all over the globe, it can see both large-scale methane emissions and individual plumes of the gas from a single oil well or compressor station. And he says they'll share information about those leaks with oil and gas companies.
Some companies don't care about the methane they emit. Many companies do, especially those that are selling the natural gas.
But Wolfsey says oil and gas companies often don't know when and where they're leaking methane.
Methane is not visible, and it's not monitored. I'm monitoring methane over all of the millions of wells and compressor stations and such is a tall order, and it's not done.
He says methane sat won't be able to catch individual leaky pipes that transport gas around cities, for example.
But the sum total of those emissions, which raise the level of methane in the city as a whole, we should be able to see that. And that's actually one of the things we're designed the satellite to do.
The goal is also for the data to be used by governments to regulate methane emissions. Wolfsey says the information will also be publicly available.
From what I've seen with some of the way people have used methane data already available from satellites, there's going to be a lot of creativity out there.
Climate change can't be stopped just by reducing methane emissions, Wolfsey points out. But that can help slow the process if we know where those emissions are coming from.
We can't bend the curve just by saying we're going to go to a meeting and tell people that they have to emit less methane. We have to have understanding about where it is. We have to have data about where the emissions are happening.
With the successful launch of MethaneSat, he says, we're one step closer to having that crucial data. For The World, I'm Craig LaMolt, Boston.
Thank you for being with us today. The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.
From PRX.